And welcome again to the Ask Beatty Show. And isn't it the truth, my friends, whether or not we are rich or poor or black or white or Jewish or Christian or Muslim or young or old or even children, we all go through so many ups and downs in our lives. And when we find that we are on a never-ending merry-go-round ride or roller coaster ride, and I'm not talking about fun rides where you just don't feel that you are on track or on your game, and you don't know why, and you don't know what to do, and you've exercised, and you've meditated, and you've taken supplements and vitamins, and you think you're doing all the right things, and yet there are things that are just really getting in the way of your life and your relationship. And I've been saying to people for the past 35 years and really been trying to encourage you and to give yourselves permission to at least look at it in this way. All you're really doing is you're wanting to get a second opinion, of course, a second professional opinion from a qualified psychotherapist or a qualified sex therapist. And it doesn't mean, you know, a lot of people really think that they're going to be in therapy forever and that it's going to be really, really expensive and it's going to be a year in and year out proposition. Now, granted, I mean, there are people, and there are people who I've treated, and there are people who I continue to treat in my practice who are actually going to need this kind of support, if not for their entire life, and it may not mean every single week, but they are going to need this kind of expert support in order to be able to continue to function well. And, you know, if you're in this category, then so be it. It's okay. It doesn't mean that you're weak. It means that you just need extra resources in order to be able to function so that you can feel that you are really at the top of your game. But I would say that the majority of people that I've seen over the years, you know, let's just say for depression as an example, you know, once we understand what the depression is really all about, and once we get to the root of the problem, which does not mean just putting a bandage on an infection, but that we really understand what happened and when was the onset, and does the depression have to do with a lot of unfinished business from our early childhood, which I have actually really found that that is typically where it begins, whether or not you were unlucky or unfortunate to grow up in a home where there was abuse of various different kinds, whether or not it was verbal abuse or physical abuse or sexual abuse or even neglect, or whether you had parents. They may have been there and they may have not been abusive in any way, but they were just simply not present so that you felt that you were on your own and you didn't really learn anything about healthy relationships or healthy communication or healthy problem solving. And of course, for most people, you don't learn any of these things in schools. And we're left to our own devices to try and figure this all out. You know, I was talking to my husband, Jim, over the weekend. And of course, most of you who've been listening to the show, the Ask Beatty Show here in the Progressive Radio Network, today is show 273. You know that I talk a lot about relationships based on my research, my clinical practice, my book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. But when Jim and I were talking, you know, I was saying to him that I never had anybody to talk to about relationships. I had a really, really close relationship with my dad, who was my tennis coach, and I think probably my life coach. My mom and I had a very different kind of a relationship. She was a teacher, and for her, things were right or wrong and black and white. But when I think about it, nobody ever sat down with me and said, "Listen, honey, this is what a good relationship is really all about. This is what needs to be. These are the ingredients that actually need to be present if you are going to have a shot at having a healthy, long-lasting relationship." So you're not alone if you don't know what a healthy relationship is, and you're not alone, as an example, if you're suffering from depression. I mean, you know that there are 350 million people worldwide, and I'm sure that number is really low, who are suffering from depression. And in the United States, we have 16 million adults. Translates into 1 in 5 Americans, 40 million adults who are suffering from a variety of different anxiety disorders. And I think that there's more depression going on now, according to studies with teenagers and young children. So if you're finding yourself in a never-ending cycle of ups and downs and depression and anxiety, and you've talked to your friends, hopefully, or you've talked to somebody, the very best thing that you really can do is reach out and ask for good quality help. And I want to give you the number here is, I want to see the number here. It's 800. I am actually looking at the live number, and I think we've had a bit of a change. But if you want to leave me a voicemail, that number is 862-800-6805. If you have any questions, if you have any comments that I've made here on the Ask Beattie Show, that number again is 862-800-6805. So depression, anxiety, relationship issues. Of course, these days we talk so much about relationships, and you know, the divorce statistics, first marriages 48% divorce rate, second marriages 63%, third marriage is 72%. So like, what is that really all about? And the point is that if we haven't looked at ourselves, if we haven't looked at the kinds of relationships that we have been in over the years, if we do not know and we're not willing to learn the ingredients that actually go into a healthy relationship and learn really, really definitively how to assess who's right for you and who's wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship. You know, I was talking to one of the staff members here on the at the Progressive Radio Network studio just before the show, and I was saying that I really wished that it was possible to fast forward the process of really getting to know someone. And you read articles, well, you can find love in 90 days, you can find love in a couple of months, you can have a life coach, you can have a matchmaker, and somehow that is supposed to help you fast forward the process of really getting to know who your partner is and is not. But the reality, at least what I found in my 35 plus years of clinical practice and my research, that it actually takes close to a year to find out who somebody is and who somebody is not. And if you're looking at sex, we're not doing that well in the bedroom. And I think a lot of people are surprised. And if you tend to look at some of the research, we see many, many, many people, many couples who are basically living in sexless relationships. And that includes people who are young. And again, if there are sexual issues, you have to figure out what is that all about? Why is it that I have no desire? Or why is it that I do not even think about sex? And, you know, sex is a very important and it's a very normal part of our lives. And again, you have to go through the different possibilities of what might be interfering with your desire and or your performance. For example, people who are feeling really depressed or anxious, or if they have a lot of unfinished business, people who were sexually abused, people who were sexually assaulted, very oftentimes are not in the moment. They have one foot in the past and they have one foot in the present, so that sex becomes something that you naturally would want to avoid at all costs. It equals abuse, perhaps. It equals harassment. So that it is always about, again, I wish there was a shortcut to all of this, but trying to figure out what are the root causes and what are the root problems, and putting bandages over all of this is not going to give you the answers, and it's not going to give you the solutions that you're wanting. And of course, if you're in a relationship with somebody who you don't like, who you're angry with, who you are upset with, where there is poor communication or no communication or poor problem solving or no problem solving, or somebody who you're simply not attracted to, certainly the majority of people are not going to be interested in sex, and certainly the majority of women are not going to want to jump into bed if they are just not feeling that kind of connection with their partner. And of course, we have to look at issues like hormones. And, with women, postmenopausal women, we see a lowering and a diminishing of estrogen. So we need to look at that. And there are a lot of natural remedies that can really help, including just a variety of supplements. And this is something that Gary Null talks about all the time, that you need to look into, because I hear a lot of women who are saying, we do not want to take hormone therapy. And I understand that totally. But there are a lot of natural options that really you should definitely explore if you're having, pain, if you're having no desire. And I know that many people, and I would say probably the majority of people, still have a lot of difficulty talking about sex. And when you go to your doctor, how often does your doctor actually ever ask you about your sex life? And that includes your gynecologist or your obstetricians. Of course, if you're seeing an obstetrician, you're probably either wanting to have a baby or you are pregnant. But these are subjects, these are really important subjects that we need to become very educated about. And in becoming educated, this is where it is important to really reach out and talk to qualified people who can give us answers, who can give us some solutions to some of the challenges that we are experiencing. So again, whether or not it is depression or anxiety or substance abuse or sexual abuse or relationship issues, if you are finding yourself in this never ending circle that doesn't ever seem to end, and that you are not getting answers and you are not feeling better and you are not finding solutions, the very best thing that you can actually do is reach out and find experts in the field who will definitely be able to help you. The other thing that I wanted to ask you about, and of course remind you, is whether or not in other areas of your life that you are doing what is in your best interest. Now, if we're looking at clinical depression as an example, you've done therapy, you're exercising, so there are other things that you need to do, such as have a complete physical. Perhaps there is a vitamin D deficiency. Perhaps there are some thyroid issues or low blood sugar or dehydration or food intolerances, or caffeine withdrawal, or perhaps you're not getting enough sleep. So again, there's just a long list of things that we really have to go through, and you don't need to do this on your own so that you can really figure out what is going on. And it is always about acknowledging, addressing, and finding whatever things that you need to find and whatever things that you need to do to resolve the problems as best as possible. You know, other things, just reminders. You know, I was sitting outside the Progressive Radio Network studio before the show, and actually there were some chairs in front of a hotel, and I was watching people smoking and drinking coffee, and I thought, my goodness, with the lung cancer incidence in this country and everything that we know about tobacco and nicotine, and here are these people. It's a beautiful sunny day here in New York City, and they are puffing away on their cigarettes. What are they doing? They're certainly not doing what is in their best interest. So some quick reminders. The Mediterranean diet, the research is absolutely clear that that diet is the healthiest diet, the plant-based diet, the fruits, the vegetables, the grains, the fish, the nuts. We can do this, but we really need to be mindful and think about, as we are going through our days, and this is something I ask my patients every single time as they are leaving their sessions, to be mindful, to think about as they go through their days and their interactions with family and friends and colleagues, am I doing what is in my best interest, including sleeping 8 hours a night and taking naps if you're lucky enough to take naps, and exercise? You know, I was just looking at more research in the fight against depression, and here's a Harvard study. 1 in 10 adults in the United States struggle with depression, and antidepressant medications are a way too common way to treat the condition. But research shows, and here it goes again and again, that exercise is also an effective treatment. And for some people, it works as well as antidepressants, although exercise alone isn't enough, for someone who has severe depression. You know, never too late to start exercising. And so when you ask yourself, am I doing everything possible, or am I doing most things that are really helpful for me so that I can feel really, really as good as I possibly can? You have to go through the list. And of course, exercise happens to be something that, you know, for me, it's been a lifesaver in a lot of ways. I've been exercising my entire life. Fortunately, my father was really knowledgeable enough to encourage me at a very, very young age. And that has helped me a lot in terms of trying to sometimes deal with some low mood and anxiety and a lack of confidence years ago. So that has been something that I have incorporated into my life. And of course, having supportive people, looking around again in your world, do you mostly have supportive people in your life? Because it is so important to eliminate toxins, the chemicals that we all know about now, but that also includes toxic people, and that sometimes means friends and family. You know, other things that just make us feel good, you know, walking, dancing, listening to music. You know, there was a really cute article in the New York Times about how having a dog can help us have a much more democratic world. And of course, getting a dog, it's great company, but it also, it's a wonderful, wonderful way to meet and socialize with people. And it's amazing because we have a cha-cha. And it's amazing the kinds of interactions and the kinds of people that we have met and that we have talked to over the years just as a result of walking the dog. What a great way to deal with barriers, you know, when you have dogs that are relating to other dogs, and hopefully the owners of the dogs will also give themselves permission to chat and talk, of course, initially about the dog and what kind of dog do you have. And it's just a great way to expand one's life. And I'm thinking too about the importance of eliminating sugar and soda and alcohol, and of course minimizing the social media and the cell phones and the computers, because we really want to be able to find a way to enjoy life, and that means trying to find a good enough balance between work and fun. So all of these reminders are things that we actually have to incorporate into our lives. And we can make a lot of excuses about why we can't do some of these things, if not all of these things. But these are things, these are evidence-based research findings that we know ultimately really can make a very, very positive difference in our lives. Well, this is the season when a lot of people, and sometimes even myself, tends to suffer from seasonal affective disorder. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about seasonal affective disorder. And you may have heard the abbreviation. It's SAD, capital S, capital A, capital D. So seasonal affective disorder, or SAD, is a type of depression that comes and goes with the seasons, typically starting in the late fall and early winter and going away during the spring and summer. Now, depressive episodes linked to the summer can occur, but are much less common than winter episodes of SAD. And this is something that many, many people do suffer from. So what are some of the signs and symptoms? Okay, seasonal affective disorder, it is not considered as a separate disorder. It is a type of depression displaying a recurring seasonal pattern. You feel that there is a switch going on in your brain. So to be diagnosed with seasonal affective disorder, people must meet full criteria of major depression. I'm not so sure that I actually agree with that. Coinciding with specific seasons, appearing specifically in the winter months for at least 2 years. Seasonal depression must be more frequent than any non-seasonal depression. So what are some of the symptoms that you may be experiencing when you're seeing that there is just not much of any sunlight outside? Well, feeling depressed most of the day, nearly every day, feeling a little hopeless, having low energy, not wanting to go outside, losing interest in activities that you once enjoyed, having problems with sleep, experiencing changes in your appetite or weight. Now, you may not have all of these symptoms, but you're starting to just feel lethargic and you can't quite get back on your game. Having some difficulty concentrating. And some people that I have treated over the years, during these months, they really start to feel, sometimes suicidal. They at least have thoughts of death and dying. And then miraculously, the season changes and spring comes and the trees are blossoming and the flowers are blossoming and the summer months are here, and those symptoms tend to lift. So symptoms of the winter pattern of seasonal affective disorder include low energy, sometimes overeating, weight gain, craving for carbohydrates, social withdrawal. I feel like hibernating. And symptoms of the less frequently occurring summer seasonal disorder, because most people during the summer, I must say, they feel pretty good. But, again, summer seasonal affective disorder, this is something that certainly in my own practice, I have not seen much, really, of any over the years, because you kind of wonder if this is a seasonal issue. When the sun is shining and the flowers are blooming, what is it that's really going on? But the fall and winter months tend to be the months when people are suffering from seasonal affective disorder. That is when it is going to happen. So what are the risk factors? Attributes that may increase your risk of seasonal affective disorder include being female. So SAD is diagnosed, and maybe that's because we women tend to seek help more often than men do, but it is diagnosed 4 times more often in women than in men. And living far from the equator, when there is much less sun, SAD is more frequent in people who live far north or south of the equator. So, for example, 1% of those who live in Florida and 9% of those who live in New England or Alaska suffer from seasonal affective disorder. So maybe we all need to move to Florida, okay? Family history. People with a family history of other types of depression are more likely to develop seasonal affective disorder than people who do not have a family history of depression. And having depression or bipolar disorder, the symptoms of depression may worsen with the seasons if you have one of these conditions. Now, young adults, and this is interesting too, have a higher risk of seasonal affective disorder than older adults, and has been reported even in children and teens. So what are the causes? This is the thing that's always so interesting, but the causes of seasonal affective disorder are really unknown. But research has found some biological clues. So what are these biological clues? So here we have that people with seasonal affective disorder may have trouble regulating one of the key neurotransmitters involved in mood, serotonin. And one study found that with seasonal affective disorder have 5% more serotonin transporter protein in winter. And if you're not exactly sure what that is something you can ask your pharmacist or your doctor, in winter months than in summer months. I know that with myself, things really tend to change when the days are shorter and when there isn't sunlight. Higher serotonin transporter protein leaves less serotonin available at the synapse because the function of the transporter is to recycle neurotransmitter back into the presynaptic neuron. So this is a little bit complicated, but what they're finding is that the serotonin levels really do change when there is a lack of sun and during the colder months. Now, people with seasonal affective disorder may overproduce, and this is interesting too, the hormone melatonin, because darkness increases production of melatonin, which regulates sleep. So as winter days become shorter, melatonin production increases, leaving people with seasonal affective disorder to feel sleepier and more lethargic, often with delayed circadian rhythms. And people with seasonal affective disorder may also produce less vitamin D. And that's really an important vitamin. I know that I take 7,000 milligrams of vitamin D every single day. So hopefully this winter is going to be a easier winter than previous winters. Vitamin D is believed to play a role in serotonin activity. So with vitamin D insufficiency may be associated with clinically significant depression symptoms. So, what are some of the treatments and some of the therapies? So, in this article, there are four major types of treatment for seasonal affective disorder. And by what I'm discussing, actually, the results are from the National Institute of Mental Health. So there are four types of treatment for seasonal affective disorder medication. And I would say that that should be the last option that you should try. Light therapy. I know that when I lived in Providence, Rhode Island, I had a light box in my office, and I found it to be very, very, very helpful. And if you want more information on that, you can just Google light therapy for seasonal affective disorder, vitamin D, psychotherapy, medication. And I would say that exercise really makes an incredible difference in our mood, whether or not you have seasonal affective disorder or depression, or whether you do not have depression or seasonal affective disorder. Exercise, of course, is just so critical if we want to have really terrific mental health. But I want to say a little bit about the light therapy. It has been a mainstay of treatment for seasonal affective disorder since the 1980s. The idea behind light therapy is to replace the diminished sunshine of the fall and winter months using daily exposure to bright artificial light. You know, one of the things is that when I moved from Providence, Rhode Island to Sarasota, Florida, I remember that I had this sale, and I thought, I am never going to need the light therapy again. Well, I'm back up north. I'm in New York City. And this is something that I'm definitely going to consider for myself, is to get another one of the light boxes. Because the symptoms of seasonal affective disorder, they may be relieved, and I used to do this every single day, by sitting in front of a light box first thing in the morning on a daily basis from the early fall. And most typically, light boxes, they filter out the ultraviolet rays and require 20 to 60 minutes of exposure to this cool white fluorescent light. And it was actually 10,000 lux, L-U-X, an amount that is about 20 times greater than ordinary indoor lighting. And I know that when I was living in Providence, whether I should or should not have, I had this light box going all day long in my office. You know, they talk also about psychotherapy, and cognitive behavioral therapy is a type of psychotherapy that is effective for seasonal affective disorder, because it actually, this behavioral activation seeks to help the person identify activities that are engaging and pleasurable, whether indoors or outdoors, to improve coping with winter. So, for example, if you know that during the fall and during the winter months that you're really starting to feel low, there are certain things that you are absolutely going to have to do on a daily basis, including, you know, perhaps, you know, getting the light box to help you feel better. And that includes, it may be some short-term therapy. It also probably should include exercise, regular exercise. I mean, what it does to our serotonin levels is really quite amazing. And if you ask most people if they're feeling down and they force themselves to go out and even walk around the block a couple of times, you can bundle up in the middle of the winter, people will report that they're feeling much, much better. It makes a big difference. And of course, I am a real proponent and a real advocate for a lot of intense exercise that really does make a difference. Not only physically does it make us really look good and keep us in shape, but it really does make a huge difference mentally and emotionally and psychologically and psychiatrically as well. And then vitamin D, and this is interesting, and I'm not pretending to be an MD, and of course Gary Null is much, much, much more the expert when he talks about vitamins and supplements than I am, but at present, vitamin D supplementation by itself is not regarded as an effective seasonal affective disorder treatment. So we're looking at a combination of things that we can actually do, including vitamin D, but not just by itself. And the reason behind its use is that low blood levels of vitamin D were found in people who experienced seasonal affective disorder. And the low levels are usually due to insufficient dietary intake or insufficient exposure to sunshine. You know, the evidence for its use has been mixed. Well, some studies suggest that vitamin D supplementation may be as effective as light therapy, and others found that vitamin D in itself had no effect. So let's look at doing a combination of things. Vitamin D, if you need some short-term psychotherapy, give yourself permission, you know, to do that. You want to incorporate the exercise into your life. And I think that if you're trying all of these different things, you're probably going to be experiencing something really positive that's going to be happening. And then again, there are some people who absolutely, they've tried everything. They exercise. They've had the light therapy. They do the vitamin D. They've had some short-term psychotherapy, and yet they still may need some medication. And if you're one of those people, don't beat yourself up. And if you're finding that even for a short time, some antidepressant medication is going to help you get through the times during the year when you're experiencing seasonal affective disorder, then take some action and find a really good psychopharmacologist or a really trustworthy psychiatrist who can monitor you and who can give you something at the lowest possible dose. I mean, that's what we're looking for, to get some results with the lowest possible use of antidepressant medication. And it really can make a really, really big difference. There was another piece about depression and seasonal affective disorder that I wanted to actually share with you. And this is an article, October 2019, How Changing Your Diet. And of course, Gary Null talks about this every single day, how changing your diet can help tamp down depression and boost mood. So what do we have? We have some fresh evidence that eating a healthy diet, one that includes, here we go again, plenty of fruits and vegetables and limits highly processed foods, can help reduce symptoms of depression. And of course, I'm always interested in the studies. And here we have a randomized controlled trial published in the journal PLOS plus and then 1 O-N-E, finds that symptoms of depression dropped significantly among a group of young adults after they followed a Mediterranean-style pattern of eating for 3 weeks. Participants saw their depression score fall from the moderate range down to the normal range, and they reported lower levels of anxiety and stress as well. Now, alternatively, the depression scores, and I think this is really important. We have good information, and I really hope that all of us really take this in and do something with the information and the research results that we are learning about. So alternatively, the depression scores among the control group of participants who didn't change their diets didn't budge. So who were these participants? So these participants continued to eat a diet higher in refined carbohydrates, processed foods, and sugary foods and beverages, and their depression scores remained in the moderate severity range. So we know that diet really does make a difference, and it does impact how we feel physically and how we feel emotionally and psychologically as well. So what did the researchers say? They said that they were quite surprised by the findings. A researcher, Heather Francis, who is a lecturer in clinical neuropsychology at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia, she told NPR via email, she thinks that the next step is to demonstrate the physiological mechanism underlying how diet can improve depressive symptoms. And scientists are learning more and more about how a poor diet can increase inflammation. And this is what Gary Null has been talking about for years. And this can be one risk factor for depression, and of course for a lot of other physical problems as well. Because what we have learned over the years is that highly processed foods increase inflammation. And what's more, if we don't consume enough nutrient-dense foods, then this can lead to insufficiencies in nutrients, which also increases inflammation. And in this particular study, and I find these studies and the study results just so interesting, the participants in the healthy eating arm of the study ate about 6 more servings of fruits and vegetables per week compared with the control group. And participants who had a greater increase in fruits and vegetables intake showed the greatest improvement in depression symptoms. So what else do we need to learn about all of this? You know, as the Nike logo tells us, we need to just do it. And participants were also instructed to increase consumption of whole grains to a recommended 3 servings per day, as well as 3 servings per day of protein from lean meats, poultry, eggs, tofu, and beans. And in addition, they were told to get 3 servings of fish per week. And as for dairy, the recommendation was 3 servings per day. That's good because I love, love, love dairy. And I know that there's been some controversy about dairy. And participants were also instructed to consume 3 tablespoons, okay, of nuts and seeds per day, as well as 2 tablespoons of olive oil, and were advised to add in spices, including turmeric and cinnamon. Okay. And one of the shortcomings of nutrition science is that it often relies on asking people to recall what they ate in the past. But given our flawed memories, these measures can be unreliable. But this study concluded in a clever way to validate how many fruits and vegetables people consumed. So the scientists, they used several research questionnaires to evaluate participants' mental health, including one that asked them how often over a prior week they'd experienced symptoms of depression. So this new study adds to a growing body of research that supports the connection between diet and mental health. And we have a highly consistent and extensive evidence base from around the globe. So this is not just one little old study linking healthier diets to reduced depression risk. And I think that this is something that's really important. And then similarly, there was a 2017 study that found that a diet rich in fruit and whole grains and vegetables and fish and olive oil and low-fat dairy was associated with, again, a lower risk of depression, whereas a diet rich in greater amounts of red meat, refined grains, sweets, and high-fat dairy products was linked to higher risk of depression. You know, so that people who are suffering depression, I mean, there really are a number of different things that people need to do, you know, over and above therapy, over and above supplements, over and above exercise. We know so much about the correlation between diet and depression. And again, it's just about doing. It is about doing what is in our best interest. And people really have to make choices about whether or not, with the knowledge that we have and the research findings that we have, whether or not they are going to self-sabotage, whether or not they are going to engage in self-destructive and destructive behaviors, or whether or not they are going to take the research findings and all of the information that we have and really, really be committed to living a life where we are engaging with people, where we are engaging in behaviors that are really in our best interests. And, you know, what's interesting, too, is that mental health doctors, and I don't know how many people who are in therapy have therapists who actually ask you about your sleep and ask you about your diet and ask you about exercise, because even so, mental health doctors should consider assessing, and this is also in this study, their patient's diet and lifestyle as a routine part of care, says a Dr. Drew Ramsey, who is a psychiatrist at Columbia University here in New York. We in the field, we need to talk to mental health patients about what they eat. When people make efforts to care for themselves and adhere to a belief system they feel is good for them, their mental health is going to definitely improve. And Dr. Ramsey teaches a medical education course for healthcare providers who want to learn more about incorporating nutrition into their practices. Now, while diet may be important to our mood and mental health, it is unlikely to be a silver bullet for treating mental illness. It is part of the picture, and here we go again, but so are physical activity, good psychological care, medication when needed, vitamins, supplements, adequate sleep, adequate exposure to nature, and balanced lifestyle. And my general take-home message, and I feel so grateful about the training that I received at McGill University, because it was really an integrative approach that we learned when we were going to be treating patients, regardless of the symptomologies, regardless of the diagnosis. So that my general take-home message is about having an integrative approach. And if you are in therapy with somebody who is not mentioning any of this, who is not discussing any of this with you, I think you really need to pause. I think it's one thing, you know, to be in therapy and you're talking about your problems and you're talking about your relationships, but the diet and the physicality are also things that really need to be looked at. And we therapists, I mean, I know myself, I don't pretend to be an MD, but I certainly have learned over the years the questions that I need to pose in order to be able to try to ensure that my patients are going to get the best possible outcome in their therapy. And this is why it is so important, if you are in therapy with somebody, that they would then refer you to a dietitian, refer you to an integrative physician who's going to be able to look at some of the physical issues that you may be experiencing that are actually getting in the way of your mental health. And I think that I want to repeat this, and I repeat this every single week, and this was a Harvard study. So not just food, not just exercise, not just supplements, not just diet or sleep, but the Harvard study, and I think it is so important that we take this all in. There was an 80-year Harvard study that says that the one thing that will make you happier and healthier, and I might add that will definitely, definitely make you feel terrific when it comes to your mental health, is making sure that you have good relationships. It is the good relationships that keep us happier and healthier. And that is the word. That is the word from Dr. Robert Wallinger, who is a psychiatrist and is currently directing the Harvard study of adult development, one of the most comprehensive studies of emotional well-being in history. So there's a long list of things, of evidence-based findings that we need to take seriously, that we really, really need to take in. And if we do these things, it will make all the difference in the world when it comes to our lives and when it comes to our relationships. And I'm amazed. I had all this material. I wanted to talk with you about Warren Buffett because he has some amazing, amazing personal insights, not just talking about investments, that I will share with you next week. But everyone, another hour has come and gone yet again on the Ask Beady Show. And I always want to thank you so much for listening and for downloading the Ask Beady archives here on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm going to leave you with my two weekly messages. And of course, the first one is that I really want you to do everything that you can possibly do to find ways to really love yourself and do what is in your best interest. And secondly, we all need to do a much, much better job around the world in learning to love each other. So again, goodbye, everybody. Have a very, very good rest of the day. This is Columbus Day, and I will talk with you next week. So take care, be well, love yourself, and let's love each other. Bye-bye.